Thanks for listening to this best of the NIDS View episodes. We hope you enjoy it as we offer you one of our most popular episodes of the past year.
Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, the podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where I, Adam Lowther, Curtis McGiffin, and Jim Petrosky have a roundtable discussion about current topics and events that are nuclear related or related to our primary adversaries. You know, deterrence is our business, so we talk about things that are related to that. And so over the weekend, the head of MI6, Britain's intelligence agency, and the CIA director had essentially a public meeting in which they talked about threats and things that were going on. And one of the things that the MI6 director said was that Vladimir Putin and Russia came very close. And those were, you know, he was being specific. It wasn't just a concern, but it was very close to the use of a nuclear weapon in 2022 in the Ukraine conflict. And so I thought that one of the things that would be useful to talk about is, you know, what would actually happen? So let's suppose Russia were to use a nuclear weapon or a small number of nuclear weapons, you know, in this, you know, the Ukraine conflict, what would happen? And we tasked Jim to talk about, you know, what's the science of it? Is the atmosphere going to catch on fire? Are we going to finally do what it takes to put an end to global warming by bringing on global winter and finally reduce greenhouse gas emissions and the Earth's temperature? Is that what we're, accomplish something good with it? What's going to happen? So we
In the age of the presidential debates, I have to say, there you go again. All right. For those that know where that comes from.
Jim. Really? Are you next going to be saying, well, Adam, I won't make fun of your youth and inexperience?
That's exactly right. I was setting you up. I just thought I'd add that in today. Thanks.
You know, so he's going to talk about, you know, sort of what would this look like, what, you know, if they decided to use, because it's probably would be one or small number of low yield theater nuclear weapons. That would be the likely use. And then Curtis and I thought, well, you know, let's talk about what might happen globally. You know, what would the United Nations do? What would the United States do? What would NATO do? How, you know, what would the Chinese do or anybody else? How would, you know, what were some of the options? Of course, we can't predict it, but we can sort of think, what would rational options be for a response to such an event? And so, of course, with that sort of foundation, Curtis, Jim, it's good to see you.
Gang's together again, aren't we? It's been a while since the three of us were together. Adam, since you set me up here, I'm going to start out and I'll do my typical tongue in cheek. So what's going to happen? Well, there's going to be a really bright flash, okay? And then a lot of stuff's going to get damaged, okay? And that's going to happen because you've got this neutron that's going to hit something and it's going to fission. It's going to cause a lot of energy release. I mean, how much detail do you want me to give? I have a couple hours here on my hand. So no, just kidding for our audience. Look, so first of all, I'm going to give you a pretty bland answer. And I know the bland answer is going to sort of start us a reeling. But here you go. Okay. If a nuclear weapon is used, there's going to be, you know, all the effects of nuclear weapons are going to happen, no matter what size. You call them theater nuclear weapons. I think of them all as they're all nuclear weapons, and they all do the same thing. They give you blast. They give you overpressure. They give you shock. They give you thermal energy, which is, you know, starts fires, which, by the way, is the biggest damaging mechanism you typically get from a surface burst nuclear weapon. And then you get And then you get you can have some electromagnetic, although on the surface, we assume that Vladimir Putin's going to, you know, launch this nuclear weapon. It's going to hit the ground. I doubt he's going to do some giant airburst, at least high enough to cause a significant electromagnetic pulse. Could, depending on what his target is, but let's just throw that off the table. Then the other two things that I think that are the things that really bother people that are going to be different from the nuclear weapon is the radiation and the dust and fallout. And those are the pieces I think are more problematic. So let me go back to my bland answer, because it's because it's not that nuclear weapons are going to do these effects, because they're more than big bombs. For our audience, a nuclear bomb is the same size as a conventional weapon. You're saying theater nuclear weapon. I just say a small bomb versus a big bomb. If he sets off a small bomb in a city or something, I use like a kiloton nuclear weapon, let's just say, or a 10 kiloton nuclear weapon, which is probably most likely. There's going to be damage in the area similar you would to a large bomb, except for these other effects. The problem is, the issue I have from the discussion, and I'll go back to a little bit of technology, but my issue with this is what leads to further nuclear use if someone uses a nuclear weapon versus not. For example, we never say, is Vladimir Putin going to use a laser? Oh, well, then we're going to use a laser. Or is Vladimir Putin's going to use, you know, a water pistol? Well, then we're going to use a water pistol. You know, it never happens except with nuclear weapons. We're always afraid to say, if he uses a nuclear weapon, we're going to use a nuclear weapon, and Armageddon's going to happen. Is that really how it's going to be responded? Is that what our strategy is? So I really am interested in the two of you thinking that through, because that's the piece that makes the nuclear weapon different. We talk about tactical, I'm going to use your word, or theater nuclear weapons. Now, there are some other issues, especially with the crowded neighborhood in which Putin might use these nuclear weapons near NATO, because there are effects such as fallout, especially such as dust and debris, such as long-term radiation in the area in which it's used, that makes the nuclear weapon a whole lot different. Aside from those blast over pressure shock and even the thermal, the fires, because you could say, well, he could just firebomb some city, which, by the way, he hasn't done. You know, I've not seen him go in and firebomb a place like we did in Dresden or we did in Tokyo. That hasn't happened. So,
hey, Jim?
Yeah.
So I guess the thing is that, you know, the Russians are as good as we are at understanding nuclear weapons effects.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty confident that he's going to use low yield or ultra low yield. He's going to have a discrete military target that he's going to take, that he's going to go after, command and control centers, something very specific that, and it's geared towards not only a destruction of a discrete capability that the Ukrainians have, but sending a message.
That's the message. I'm agreeing that part.
But I don't actually think we're going to see, I think it's going to be a fallout free height of burst. We're not going to see, a lot of these, we're going to see minimal weapons effects. And because you get your optimal, I mean, as you know, you get optimal weapons effects from an air burst, not from a ground burst.
Okay.
And so I think that it's going to be, and the Russians really have thought through how to employ nuclear weapons. And when to do it, how to achieve discrete objectives, and, you know, things like how to not entice the Americans into using weapons as well. And so I see the science of this is being more important here, because from what I've read in a lot of the sort of the popular media, the discussion of the science is hyperbolic. And it's not helpful and it's not useful. And it always goes to a place that this, the probability for those of us who have worked in the nuclear enterprise and done this kind of work, they're just really far off base. So I want you give us that more accurate understanding of what that science looks like.
I can do that. And I was heading there, but I want to point out, it's about a messaging. When you get to low and ultra low yield nuclear weapons, you then are, again, blast overpressure and shock from an airburst nuclear weapon, very, very similar. than you could get from a conventional weapon. So it's a message that gets sent and not some other piece of the warfare that we're working with. And so why would you do that unless, one, you think the strategy is that your adversary is going to quit after you do that, or number two, you want the escalation, which I doubt they want the escalation, because I think it's a losing battle. So let's go back to the, hang on, Adam. No, I agree. So when you think, my point is, when you start talking about nuclear weapons in that way, it opens a Pandora's box of where you go from there. And I want to know what the strategy is on both sides, because not what the adversaries do, not what Putin does, but what does the U.S. do when Putin does what he does? That's the real question. I'm curious what you and Curtis think. So we'll get there. So now let's talk about, I get it. The run to the hills, a small yield nuclear weapon has been detonated in the air over City X. I'm not going to name a city.
No, over some command node of the Ukrainian military. So they're probably not in a city.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of space around there, but okay, I'll go there. So even if you did it over a command post in the middle of nowhere, okay, what's going to happen? Blast. Okay, first of all, you're up in the air, right? So when you're in the air, you produce very little fallout. The bomb debris does create a little bit of fallout. You have some of that debris. The air gets activated. It becomes a little bit of fallout, but a very, very low radiation hazard. In the immediate vicinity, you obviously have the blast, especially if it's an optimal height of burst detonation. You get a lot of damage from that overpressure, the damage to the ground, which why I say if it's a hardened military facility, I'm not sure what you're really going to get out of this on an airburst, but we'll continue to go there. The third piece is, from the radiation standpoint, it's instantaneous, just like we saw, an airburst we did over Nagasaki and Hiroshima. That's why I go back to the city for comparison. But what you end up having is you have mostly, thermal energy that's reaching the ground and causing a majority of your damage if there are facilities nearby. What you don't have is in an airburst situation, and again, I'm not sure, out in the middle of nowhere, underground bunker, whatever, very hard target to take out with that kind of facility, but we'll go there. But you don't get the fallout. You don't get the large radiation impact on the ground. You don't get the fallout that's transported to, over Europe and over other cities and causing damage for long periods of time. None of that occurs. Okay. And that's the piece here that's sort of interesting. In fact, if you go again, a low yield, ultra low yield, we're talking about, even if you put a detonation at the optimal height of burst, we're talking about a fireball roughly about, 200 meters in diameter ish. Okay, for like up to a 10 kiloton nuclear weapon, you get ultra low yield. You're talking very, very small fireball. You're talking very low levels of damage. And again, the radiation hazards are very small. The dust and the dust and debris, very small in an airburst. And you get fairly close to the ground. You get a pretty good shock. But the facility, if it's hardened, still very hard to take out with a nuclear weapon that way. That's why when you say the Russians have designed it this way, it's very hard to do that from an ultra low yield weapon. That's the problem. There's ground slap, but it doesn't really, for a hardened target. Easy targets are cities. They drop very easily. So let me go back to you.
Well, I guess I would say, one of the things, take airfields, for example. This is one of the things Jim McHugh and I were looking at, was what does it take? How many accurate PGMs, which the Russians' PGMs haven't been as accurate as we originally thought they were. And you needed to take out a standard, U.S. Air Force airfield with airframes on it. You needed about 80 PGMs, but you needed 5 low-yield nuclear weapons.
Yep.
And so there's a big difference. And there was a point in 2022 in which they were getting really low on munitions, and they were not proving as effective as they had thought they would. So airfields, for example, command posts. So the Ukrainians at the, first couple of years, they didn't have any hardened and deeply buried targets. They had none. Yeah. So they might've had hardened concrete shelters above ground, but none of it was deeply buried. So, the sort of ultra low yield, like 100 tons, you know, that's 10 times bigger than the largest conventional munition. And that's the smallest munition or smallest nuke. And so that's like a big bomb still. You know, that's still a really big bomb that can destroy these kind of, you know, airfields, command posts, all that stuff. One kiloton is, you know, that's a really big one relative to what conventionals are. And yet by nuclear standards, it's tiny. Yeah. And so these can be really effective in ways to hit discrete military targets that I don't think we've thought about. We sort of seem to think it's always going to be ICs going across the poles and, you know, it's all or nothing. And that's sort of the misnomer that's been set up.
No, I don't disagree with that. You get a large area you get a large area of damage from, you know, larger than you would from a conventional weapon. But at that point, you know, you got to weigh this out. And maybe I've, you know, taken a different view on this because we always look at each other's side. I look at the other side like, why would you open that Pandora's box? That's the question, you know, and I'm not sure where we go with there. But just to give you some ideas, again, you know, you think about, you know, you talk about a 100-ton a weapon. So even at a 100-ton weapon at its optimal height of burst, you're still talking, you know, damage, you know, 5 PSI, which probably would, you know, disable, you know, be moderate. I guess that's moderate damage range. I think it's 5 PSI, if I remember correctly. You know, it's only out, the area target is about an area of about a circle of about 300 meters. So on an airfield, if you have airplanes out in the open, again, I think of, you know, aircraft out in the open, that to me is a soft target on the ground. That's not a hardened target. But certainly could be used that way. But again, you're opening Pandora's box for something that there may be some better fitting for. So the question is, why would you do that? Now I know why I'd threaten it. But I want to hear your side. Cause my, you know, I'll listen to your side. So I'll let, cause Curtis is just waiting to talk. He's just looking at us like he is, I don't know what you're doing there, Curtis. So let's listen to what Curtis has to say before I jump back in. Cause I will jump back in.
Curtis. Well, I've just been enjoying the discourse here, back and forth. I think you guys are a little bit ahead of the argument here. I mean, it's fascinating, the science, the realization of the warfighting capability of low-level nukes. And I, for one, am not necessarily a believer in the Secretary Mattis sort of, I don't know, doctrine or statement that any nuke of any yield is a strategic weapon, right? Because he's thinking of it. He was thinking of it, I presume, in a matter of how, what kind of reaction that would draw. But I think of it differently. I think of it as, what is the effect you're trying to achieve? And so the question then is, to take your argument one step further, if you will, but I'm going to go backwards, is why would Putin use a nuke back in November, fall-ish of 2022, as a sort of intimated in this piece here between these two intelligence leaders in what was referred to as a mystery session, sounds kind of fun, that was conducted here between CIA Burns and MI6 at Richard Moore. I guess they couldn't hire a guy named Roger Moore. But in any case, the answer here is what is the effect? I don't believe that Putin is trying to incite a war by using a low-level nuke in Ukraine. I don't think that he needs to use a low-level nuke to somehow take out, you know, a command node in Ukraine, unless there's one that's deeply buried or something along those lines. I think that the purpose of a possible nuke use, especially during the time frame of the fall of 2022, as these two gentlemen discussed as a huge possibility, is to turn the tide of the war. It's not to continue the war. It's to end it. It's to terminate it. And in order to do that, I believe that the Russians would likely have detonated this low-yield weapon within Russia, either in one of their testing grounds or in Siberia. They would have done it above ground in violation of all the treaties. Why should that be shocking? Okay. With a full mushroom cloud to be viewed by the world. And the goal is to move from nuclear coercion to nuclear blackmail. Right. And so Jim, what that means is, and to all of our listeners, is we want to get nuclear coercion occurs before the detonation, right? It's a threat that I will detonate.
Yeah.
Nuclear blackmail is the threat that I've detonated once, and if you don't want me to do it again, you will do X, Y, or Z.
Yeah, so was the whole Cold War nuclear blackmail? Because we and the Soviets were, you know, detonating above and below ground all the time.
The Cold War cycle here is one thing, but I'm talking about in the Ukraine crisis here. The goal is to compel the West to capitulate to Putin's needs. Or his desires, his victory, whatever you want to, however you want to define that, end the war. And rather than negotiate a war or continue to throw bodies at the conventional meat grinder, it's possible that there was considerations at this time to go ahead and do a demonstrating detonation followed by a nuclear blackmail threat to say, hey, free world, if you don't want this to happen again and maybe closer to the war, you will do X, Y, and Z, and place then the onus of fear upon the West. And so that is what I believe is the goal here. And it is about war termination and not war continuation. And so by doing it in his country, possibly at a test site, which is prepared in some way to possibly at least minimize the effects downrange, you know, NATO can't say, well, you detonated it in our backyard. They can't say you detonated it in another country. And maybe even they can moderate or modulate the international condemnation. Again, they detonated it in their country. Yeah, that's the whole point is to shock the world to say, whoa, he means business. We need to rethink what the West is doing in this Ukraine crisis. That's the goal of any potential detonation. My guess is in November, they decided prudently that that's not where we want to go yet. The question is, will they get there soon? If you've lost between 400 or 300 and 500,000 casualties, you know, how much more can you suffer before you finally say, enough is enough. I've got to do something drastic to end this war. And yeah, that's the challenge here.
Curtis, yeah, I think there's three points I want to just add to what you say. It's not that Putin wants to end a war. He wants to end the war in his favor. He wants his terms to be brought.
Yes,
I know. I just want, you know, because he could end the war tomorrow. Okay, so there's more to it than just ending the war. The other piece, and the reason why I came out the way I did when Adam asked the question, is exactly what you said. Now I want to go back to the technology that fits your argument. I was waiting for that. And that is that it says at the very beginning of this this article about the from the Washington Times, and I like the word because I sort of thought about it. It says, the U.S. and its allies should not be unnecessarily intimidated. Okay, first of all, when are we necessarily intimidated? I don't know. We never want to be intimidated. It's always unnecessary to be intimidated. Okay, but the second piece is, so why does these use unnecessarily? And this is my interpretation. May not be right, you know, from the reader, but I'm going to just take my, you know, artistic license here and say exactly where Adam was going. And that is, we are unnecessarily intimidated when we think that if Putin were to set off a nuclear weapon, and as Curtis said, and this is where I was heading, is we've tested nuclear weapons for years, and we aren't, you notice the entire country is not covered in radiation. Sure. We don't have people keeling over from radiation sickness. We don't have huge swaths of land out in Alamogordo Valley and Nevada that can't be inhabited. Yes, there are a small area where they did many nuclear tests, but the point is that we are unnecessarily intimidated because we treat the nuclear weapons as though once someone pushes that button in terms of a negotiating tactic, what does the U.S. do? And this is, what do? We back down and we give the terms that Putin wants. And this is where our strategic view and our diplomatic view has got to change, because you give the adversary the upper hand and you allow them to deter our actions. Mm-hmm. Okay. So deterrence is us. So I said it twice for emphasis, deter, third time, our actions in the Ukraine, so that the Putin can end the war on his terms. We Correct. Don't want that. And that's where I see this issue. From a technical standpoint, though, Adam, I agree with you 100%. This is not the run for the hills, the world's on fire, radiation spread everywhere else. In fact, there is a way to do this that you reduce the amount of radioactivity that goes in places. In fact, we did that. I'm going to go back to my example. Hiroshima, Nagasaki. We knew that our airburst nuclear weapons would allow us to occupy if we wanted to. That's a historic fact that the scientists knew that. And so we had airburst nuclear weapons, and we got a bigger effect by airburst nuclear weapons because we had a larger area of coverage versus a groundburst nuclear weapon. So that's as good news, as much as we need to go into the science and technology here. There's no other piece there. And from a technical standpoint, building a small nuclear weapon takes a lot of technology, but it's capable of being done in a small manner, as you had expressed, because we've seen it in our own, I won't say backyard now because I don't live in Nevada or New Mexico, but if you live in New Mexico or Nevada, this was done in your backyard and you're living through it, and it's fine. And I'm glad we did it.
See, I tell you guys, I think y'all are dead wrong about what the Russians and Vladimir Putin are thinking. I don't think they'll use it in that way. I don't think they'll use it for that purposes. I think the Russians, that's a very American way of thinking about it, because we're used to running we're the global leader, and we have these sort of big strategy of managing, multiple theaters, and that's who we are, but that's not really who the Russians are. They've never thought that way. They've always been much more insular focused. They think in much smaller terms. And the Russians really think about nuclear weapons, particularly small ones. I mean, they think if they start launching ICs at the US, we'll respond. They very clearly think about that. But I don't think that they're thinking about, what's this grand effect on war winning power of, a small, of a detonation in, Eastern Siberia. I don't think they think that way. I think they think we have an objective to achieve now, because they have a way of fighting, and their way of fighting is to outlast adversaries.
Mm-hmm.
And they came up against, hard problems in terms that Putin he didn't expect. He had been being lied to the whole time. They were stealing, selling all kinds of stuff. So he realized, I don't have what I thought I had, and it ain't as capable as I thought, and I need something better. And I think the Russians really see nuclear weapons, because think about, 2014, what they learned in Little Green Men in Crimea. And then, they essentially invaded Ukraine years before, because how long have we been fighting in the Don, or not we, but the Ukrainians been fighting in the Donbass? Mm-hmm. So we've been telling the Russians for years, and for a decade, well, almost a decade by 2022, that you can take territory because it's not a member of NATO and we'll do nothing. So I don't think the Russians thought that this was a war winning strategy. I think they want to fight. That they're thinking about fighting, they're thinking about battles, they're thinking about achieving objectives, stemming losses, and they're much more operational and tactically focused than we are.
So, Adam, I have a question for you. So I'm going to turn this one on its head, and that is that if I read these articles multiple times, because there's a lot of meat in these, but the same thing keeps coming up. It's about saber rattling, intimidation, et cetera, et cetera. But if I follow, so I like looking at it from another angle. So I'll look at life from your angle. So if that is Russia's way of fighting, and they're losing this large number of people over this extended period of time, and they see the U.S. is there, why didn't they set off nuclear weapons? What stopped them?
Because they found alternatives. I mean, they tried to weigh the risk. They weighed it all. They thought, you know, what do we gain? What do we lose? It was still relatively early in the war. They've now played through all of the sanctions, all of the integrated deterrence that the U.S. has employed against them. And they've said, our economy is growing faster than the American economy. We've got new allies and partners. The world isn't united like we feared it could be. So I would submit to you, they had an immediate need on the battlefield at that time that they feared losses because of, you know, poor equipment, lack of ordnance, all that kind of stuff. I now think that, you know, that fear has been met by the North Koreans and the Chinese. But the other side of that is now they don't fear nuclear use because they already know that we don't have a bunch of other tools that we're going to be able to effectively use against them. So I would submit to you, if they get in the same position, they're more likely to use them next time.
So Adam, so I'd say then, if you go back to the transcript of this podcast, and I suggest everyone does that, isn't that what I said up front? That there's no practical reason when you have other alternatives on the line because of the Pandora's box that it would open. There's still, nuclear is special in its war fighting effect. I'll use Curtis's words. It is special in its effect, not just in the death and destruction it has caused, because it can, you know, from a very small bomb cause a very large amount of damage and a lot of death and a lot of misery. Okay, that can happen from a nuclear weapon. It's special. But because it's special, you don't want to open that Pandora's box. And so sounds like Putin went right down the road that I went. It's not worth it. It's not worth the risk, because the risk on that return is very small. You could do it with something else. And that's where we are now.
Well, I just think he didn't get to the point where he felt he had to. He had it on the table. It was an operational decision. And he said, I've still got depth. I've still got depth in my magazine before I have to do this. Because there's more risk because we haven't been using them. Now, whenever he says, I got no more magazine depth, then I think he's going to use them and he's not going to worry about, you know, all of the signaling and all of that other stuff.
I think the U.S. would be the same, though, don't you think? If we saw that we were fully in a truly existential threat, that someone was sitting on our border, there were ships out inside the harbor.
That's not what we're talking about in Ukraine, though. That's not Ukraine.
That's right. That's my point. So we're comparing apples and oranges, which is my point.
No, my point is he was going to use them in Ukraine if he ran out of conventional munitions and still had to move forward.
But he won't.
And fortunately for us, he didn't run out.
It's not existential to him. That's the point.
But he was close. Well, and he doesn't see them as special and taboo. And they don't view it
taboo.
That way.
I didn't say taboo. I do say special. Otherwise, they'd have been using them. They would have used them in Afghanistan instead of having their butts handed to them.
No, their military was much bigger during Afghanistan in 77. I would say that to your point, Adam, I agree with much of that premise. I think, though, that because Putin hasn't used them all of this time. So in this time frame now that they were talking about was 7 months into the war, nearly 2 years ago. Okay, so there is our context for our listeners.
Yeah.
And the world, and it's much different now. He has sustained a lot more losses since then.
Yep.
But he has adapted a Western mindset that if I go to this well, it's going to be once, and then I'm going to have to be all in on that. And again, he is all in on Ukraine. The problem here is that when you listen to U.S. strategists, Western strategists, I'll include MI6 and whatnot in there, is that they have a hard time understanding or perceiving, if you will, from his point of view, that what is going on is a catastrophic or existential threat to his state, which is within his doctrine. Everybody seems to say, as you go through the readings, that his nuclear doctrine says that he won't use it unless his state is at risk. But no one really defines what he thinks that might be. We will push that perception upon him and say, well, we wouldn't perceive his risk to be upon his state. But the reality is that he might. let me remind everybody, at this time of this recording, the Ukrainians have entered and occupied hundreds of square miles of Russian territory.
Okay. They're now bombing Moscow. They've just recently bombed Moscow.
Exactly. And they're doing it with Western weapons. I presume that there are Western weapons that are helping them occupy this land. I'm not going to debate the strategy of why they're doing it. It's maybe right or wrong. That's not the point. The point is the effect of how does it change Putin's perception, and does it make him more or less likely to want to detonate a small nuclear weapon in order to demonstrate to the rest of the world, I have had enough. I've become intolerant to what you are imposing upon me. He has used the terms strategic defeat, that the West is trying to impose strategic defeat upon him. And the reality here is this war is only going to end, I think, one way, and that's with Putin either dying in office or being removed from office. And I think the former is probably more likely than the latter. And so we have to figure out, if we can't get to a negotiated issue, and I don't think we can, he's going to have to do something, because he's not going to continue to withstand and tolerate these kinds of issues. And regardless here, at some point in time, Ukraine, who has Russia, who has a population 4-to-1 ratio to Ukraine, when Ukraine begins to run out of conventional manpower, what does the West do after that? And so let me pose a final question to you as we round out here, as the afternoon commute is terminating here. And that is the U.S. more likely, in response to whatever, a small nuke, a massive, a big surge by the Russians, is the U.S. more likely to commit ground troops or commit its nuclear weapons to the defense of Ukraine?
Neither.
Okay, so then if that's the answer, then what the hell are we doing here? Yep. Are we? How does this end?
That's my pose to you, because you're the strategy and policy people. We have to have a strategy and a policy that allows this to end in the best manner for us as well. And when we talk about nuclear weapons, I always go back and say the technology, et cetera. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's nuances and value in upgrading and engineering and everything else. But the bottom line from a military aspect is we know what's going to happen. The question is, how do we prevent it from happening? That's what deterrence is. We're trying to keep from having, nuclear deterrence is about preventing a nuclear war. And that comes down to policy and strategy. How do we let Putin have a soft landing? Can he have a soft landing at this point? I don't think so. I think, like you said, he's all in. So if there's no soft landing, what's the next step? Because we don't want to push this to the point where where the bully, instead of punching you in the nose, pulls out the gun and shoots you. Because now you've provoked the bully the wrong way. You got to punch him in the nose and back him up, not have him get aggravated and pull out the gun. I know maybe my analogy is not good, but you get the point. He's playing a bully. He's intimidating us, and we're reacting in the way we do. We shouldn't be, what was the wording used? Unnecessarily intimidated. Okay? It's unnecessary. We should think it out.
Unfortunately, we are out of time for this discussion, so we're going to have to cut it off.
There's more to talk about. Our audience wants more.
So, of course, thanks to Curtis and Jim. We didn't even get a chance to talk about how the international community might respond to such a nuclear use.
They would respond badly.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that would matter, though. Curtis. Marshes.
Curtis' summary is pretty
well,
good.
After he detonates a nuke, a strongly worded letter is the best remedy.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Okay, well, hopefully you, the listeners, enjoyed that no matter what, or at least enjoyed the back and forth. Or maybe, hopefully, you were joining me in saying they're wrong because, all right people agree with me. But occasionally, it's okay to agree with Curtis or Jim if they don't agree with me. So, of course.
Quite magnanimous of you.
We want to, of course, thank
you. Wrong again, Adam. Wrong again.
Thanks for joining us on this episode. And of course, as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.